This is an Equity Bates Media podcast.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Equity Minds.
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is you can.
Welcome to another episode of Equity Mates, a podcast that follows our journey of investing. Whether you're an absolute beginner or approaching Warren Buffett status, our aim is to help break down your barriers from beginning to dividend. My name is Bryce, and as always, I'm joined by my equity buddy, Ren. How are you?
I'm very good, Bryce. I'm very excited. We have our first guest in our new studio.
Yes.
This will be a trivia question one day. Who was the first guest at the Equity Mates studio?
You think you're excited?
It is our absolute pleasure to welcome to the new studio, Julian McCormack. Welcome, Julian.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
So just a quick reminder before we start that we're not experts, we're not financial professionals, we're not licensed. We're just here learning like you, and nothing on this podcast should be taken as advice. Julian is an expert though, so don't listen to us.
Don't listen to us. Still don't take everything Julian says as advice, yes. But he is licensed under Platinum. And we're going to be learning a lot from him today.
But not licensed to give advice.
That's it.
It's not legal advice. It's illegal for me to provide advice.
Yes. Okay. And as we always say, just generally don't take financial advice from a podcast.
Totally.
Yeah.
And can I just say one thing with that? I think it's really important to express to people, if you take anything seriously in your life, get a coach.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So there's a bit of a perception, I think, around financial matters that I should be so clever, I should do it myself. And I like to say to people, do you reckon Rafael Nadal knows a lot about tennis? Probably knows a lot about tennis, right? Mm. Does he have a coach? He has a whole coaching staff.
Yeah.
Right, so if you're going to take this seriously, go get a coach.
Yeah.
Just get accountable, get serious, it's hugely important. And the more you think you can't afford it, probably the more you should do it. It's money very, very well spent. You can go and talk to these people for free for one, you know, see if you have a meeting of minds, whatever, a financial planner, financial advisor, whatever. But it's actually really important.
Mm. Mm. Good shout,
yeah.
Well, if you haven't come across Julian before, we had him on our Ausbiz show way back in 2021, I think it was.
Was it?
Something like
2020?
That.
It was in lockdown time.
Yeah, there was a lot of COVID issues.
Julian is an investment specialist at Platinum Asset Management. And today we're going to be covering all things current market conditions, where to from here, and where Platinum are seeing opportunities.
Yeah, so Julian, for people who haven't watched our Ausbiz show and may be coming across you for the first time, we always love to start with the story of someone's first investment. We find there's a good story, good lesson that comes out of it. So, do you remember the story of your first investment?
Yeah, totally. Crystal clear. So first stock I ever bought was Macquarie Bank. I was about 19 or 20. Stock was 18 bucks.
Yeah.
I was doing an internship with a group called Capital Partners back then, which became CP2. That was just pure nepotism. That was just a friend of the family who needed someone to do the filing type stuff, and I was at uni and that all worked out really well. They were working in infrastructure, and their basic thing was, boiled down to, the cost of capital for these very stable infrastructure type businesses is way lower than everyone thinks. And the only other mob who they saw who knew that was Macquarie. So that was the early days of things like Hills Motorway and Transurban and blah, 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 these early public partner, public-private partnership things that went around and hoovered up, you know, these sort of toll road type investments. Mm. And the only other guys out there, guys and girls, I use that term generically, who got it was Macquarie Bank. And so I, and then so just got to know a little bit about the culture of Macquarie Bank. My brother-in-law worked there. My sister had worked there. And just got an appreciation of what that thing kind of was. Didn't really know anything about the balance sheet because that's unknowable. Didn't really know much about, you know, what the potential risks around the financial sector were, you know, at that point, which became apparent about 10 years later. But it just looked like something that was robust and had an edge on everybody else relative to a big sector. And I thought that's sort of pretty good. And then I flogged that about, I'm going to say, in about 2007.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, so I was going to say.
That went all right. Yeah, that was good.
I mean, it's kept going all right after that.
I know. Yeah. I should have never flogged it. And I never went back and rebought it, by the way.
No.
But that's actually, when you read the sort of masters, that's something they do really well.
Yeah.
Is they, oh, well, I missed that, but I'll just buy it now. Or... Mm. That's a good discipline's the wrong word. It's just a good practice.
Yeah,
you know, to always remember to go back to things.
Bought at 18 and it's now 180. So
yeah, and I flogged it at 80. So it was sort of low 80s. Yeah, it was fine.
Be happy with that.
Well played. Yes. Following that, have you developed an investment philosophy, or like what's the investment philosophy that carries through Platinum?
Yeah, so let me talk about Platinum because that's better than my investment philosophy. My personal investment philosophy is I'm very comfortable to wear massive amounts of risk, and also I don't ever want to run third party money because I just observe what it's like doing that.
Yeah.
It's not much fun. So if you do well, it's the client's idea. If you do badly, it's your idea. So it's this lovely sort of, you know, sort of thing. So, but at Platinum, we're very lucky to have a business that's built over repeated instances that bond people to our business. And most young investors don't have any appreciation of that. And so as a result, we have a relatively old client base, you know, in terms of age. Who've been through either one or two cycles with us. And so we have a business because of what happened 2000 through 2004. And then we gelled people under the business, welded people under the business with what happened in 08, 09, 10. Mm-hmm. And then since then we've been pretty mediocre, really, to be frank. In terms of performance, we'd be the first to say that, first to volunteer that. You know, we did things like, you know, told everyone how great Microsoft was in 2010, sold it in 2013.
Oh, no.
That's fine. I mean, that's what we do. So, but what's that reflective of? Let me take a step back and say what I think people don't have a great appreciation of is that we are acting in the fog of war. We cannot wait for proof. We cannot wait for things to be known because by the time you do that, it is too late.
Mm.
That is what that thing out there is. That's what the economy is. It's a massive, you know, mathematically chaotic thing that's unknowable. And I think there's a sense that the general public gets with investment that if I just had a better mousetrap and more data to put in the mousetrap, then I'd know everything and I could predict anything. But you can't. It doesn't work like that. It's much more like, you know, systems under great stress. In material sciences, you get to points of criticality and then it's, you know, you sort of know the outcomes but you can't know with any certainty when they'll happen. Or subatomic particle physics, where you can know a bit about a particle but not all of it. So Heisenberg uncertainty means you can't know direction, spin and velocity all at the one time. If you know one, you know the others less mathematically. That's what this is like. So then what does a philosophy mean? A philosophy from there is just a guideline that helps you deal with that fog of war. And so it lets you know, okay, I don't know this is the right thing to do, but I know this is why I should do it, right? And that's really, really important. because it just means you don't get suckered in one way or the other. The thing I'm thinking of is you don't get suckered into bubbles. You might miss a bit of fun on the way up, but you don't have massive drawdowns on the way down because of what you're doing. The reverse of that is also true. And I fully acknowledge that. There are brilliant growth investors out there. And all that happens is over cycles, returns cluster. So different people make different returns at different times. Everyone. Yeah. Everyone. So no one ever makes their average return every year, right? I mean, Bernie Madoff did.
Yeah, true, right?
So, you know, that was his thing. Everyone else has these periods where they suck.
Yeah.
If you understand why something sucks and if it's sucking at the right time, that should actually be fine because it means, okay, I get why that might be or whatever. And then you can actually and that has informational value for you. You can then say, okay, well, maybe I shouldn't use that manager now, or if I expect the conditions that drive that performance to continue, maybe I shouldn't use this mob right now. So that's all by way of prevarication, obfuscation and background. But so what do? We basically sell expensive and buy cheap.
Yeah.
And the way we can do that, because those terms don't mean anything. Cheap doesn't mean anything. Expensive doesn't mean anything. Because if you can get a Ferrari for 200 grand, it's cheap. It's cheap. If you're forced to buy a 1994 Corolla for 100 grand, it's super expensive, right? So obviously. So how do we know what's cheap and what's expensive? There's a whole bunch of things we can know. So the first point is valuation versus itself versus other things versus itself over time versus other things. That's the first point. It's really obvious. The next thing we can know is how are people positioned versus that thing? Do people love it? Do people hate it? Do people own a lot of it? Is it under-owned? Are there flows going into it? Are there flows coming out of it? That's extremely helpful. And then we can know how does that thing perform, you know, in different parts of the economic cycle, you know, as a bit of a cyclical thing as opposed to a structural thing. So that boils down to we are looking for things that are overlooked and neglected, and they happen all the time. They happen all the time. And what's more, they sort of seem to be happening more.
Okay.
That's the interesting thing.
Mm.
And I think there's a sense in this cycle that technology has allowed us all to become great investors, and I think there's just a hell of a lot of wood and people can't see the trees, and that's leading to massive valuation dispersion, and that's amplified by this incredible initially monetary and latterly fiscal experiment we've all lived through that's amplified that cycle.
Mm.
So if anyone, you know, what wants a quick summary of where we see the world, the setup's really bad for risk assets from here, and especially from here now.
Mm.
You know, 6 weeks ago we could have had this chat and I would have felt like, oh, everyone thinks that, mate.
Yeah.
And everyone was bearish. Hey, that went away pretty quick.
Bryce and I were just speaking about this. The sentiment has changed so quickly. And, you know, the NASDAQ composite is up 20% from its June lows.
Yep.
Australia's tech sector up 30% from its lows.
Yeah.
It's funny how things change quickly. Let's put a pin in overlooked things and where you're seeing some overlooked things, because we'll get back to that. But let's start with this macro picture and what's happening. You feel like maybe people forgot how risky the stock market was a little bit too quickly in the last month. So I guess tell us what Platinum's view is, what your view is of the macro environment, you know, inflation, recession, bear market, all that stuff.
Yeah. So let's start with a start point, which is where were we coming from at the end of last year? And that was about the most expensive that equity markets have been in their history.
Mm.
So that's not a good start point. Now, why do I say that? So and we could look at price to earnings, price to book, price to sales, enterprise value to invested capital, market cap to GDP. On the average of all those things, we were about the most expensive we'd ever been, largely in the US, which then dominates the MSCI International All Markets, you know, average, right? Because that's 60% of the average.
Yeah.
So on average, that market was very, that index and those pair of indices, you know, the S&P and the MSCI, were about as expensive as they've ever been. That doesn't convey any information though, conveys limited information because expensive can get more expensive. What I like to impose upon people is a thought experiment, and just, it's very trivial, so bear with me. You might have seen this before, but if I get a balloon, it's very fully inflated, and I pop that balloon with a pencil. Pencil has to be reasonably sharp. It's a pacer. Right.
It's a pacer is something I haven't thought about in a long time.
Exactly. I'm going back to the school, pencil case and getting probably a relatively thick, maybe half a mil pacer. Pop it. Did the pencil pop the balloon?
Mm.
And you think, yeah, of course it did, you idiot. But now let me get the same balloon, same make of balloon from the same packet of balloon and inflate it, only one third. And now I hit the balloon with that pencil and it won't pop. So the pencil didn't change. Mm. It's the air in the balloon that's doing the popping and the pencil just helps. So what happens in cycles is as the balloon inflates, it becomes self-fulfilling for the participants, for the air in the balloon to believe that the balloon is inviolable. Right? Because they see the balloon, they feel the balloon, they're in the balloon as it inflates and everyone's making money, it's all good, it's all fine. And then so the possibility of a pop loses any veracity or mental possibility for the people in it. Because, hey, mate, you don't need to tell me about Netflix, I've been here for 10 years. You don't need to tell me about Microsoft, I've been here for, right? That certainty, paradoxically, is what makes cycles possible. And every cycle is the same. And we live in an economic system that is cyclical.
Mm.
That is what capital does, right? Right. So capitalism is really simple, right? The iron law of capital is return on capital, right? So you have to get a return on capital. How is that determined? By price. Price goes up, capital comes in. Price goes down, capital goes out. But then we can tell ourselves that no, this is a structural grower. Inflation is, we're in a secular stagnation now. See how they're different? They're things that are not cyclical. They're known. So now I have a certainty on which I can build my worldview, and they're not subject to debate. No. You don't have to tell me about that. It's because think about it. Maybe a year ago there was a bit of doubt creeping in, but most people were really wedded to, hey man, this inflation is transitory. It's like, look, it's debt, it's demographics, it's technology. We'll never have much inflation. We're in a very different environment now. It's all known. And so that certainty lets them build an incredible cyclical bubble.
Yeah.
A really staggering cyclical bubble.
Mm.
And the certainty that gives people is what leads to that bubble. So it's the belief that we're not in a bubble. The knowledge, in inverted commas, that we're not in a bubble, that can lead to a bubble. It's really paradoxical.
Mm.
And it's also, again, not all that helpful, because you don't know halfway through the bubble how big the bubble can get. Expensive can always get more expensive. And so you get this behavior where a house of cards gets higher and higher and higher and taller and taller and taller, and the taller it gets, the more stable it feels.
Mm.
That's the start point. Fully acknowledge that could be wrong. Fully acknowledge that this might not be anything like what I'm describing, because millions of economic agents are doing the reverse of what I'm saying. So let's be humble about that. Let's go back to that fog of war, right? Napoleon couldn't wait around at Austerlitz and think, maybe that guy will go there, so I should take that hillside. He couldn't wait till the guy went there, because then it was too late, right? You can't. It's not a mechanical process where someone comes with a PowerPoint and says, I've proven it. We're off to the races. We know. It is a constant state of uncertainty that we're dealing with. And therefore, you've got to sort of watch out for what the boundary conditions of these things are. And we got to really radical boundary conditions.
Mm.
So if you look at the valuation of markets versus all of the great bubble episodes of history, so I'm not going to go back too far, but you think, so the US in 1929, the US in 1967, Japan in 1989, China in 2007, the US in 2000 in the tech boom, we reached a level of market valuation that rivaled all of those. And people need to know, understand, and have a sense of, from those points, markets fell by more than half every time and often didn't make new highs for decades, if ever.
So on that, markets fell by more than half each time. We saw about 20% in the S&P 500, a bit more in the NASDAQ, and then it's rallied a bit from there. So are you saying the worst is yet to come?
From my perspective, absolutely, irrefutably, that's what it looks like. And so why would I say that? I think where the market's narrative, where the market's prevailing bias right now is, well, the big problem's inflation. That's triggering action by the Fed. If the inflation comes off, the Fed can pivot and we're all good. And that's what I see being demonstrated in
market behavior.
I have
actually seen that a lot on like Instagram and social media in the last like 24 hours. Yeah.
Now, when I think we did a post. Well, I did one this morning called Stocks Are Bad.
Did you? He's the problem.
It was a piss take. Yeah, but.
No, Bryce, by the way, it could be right.
About content clickbait here. Yeah. So that
engagement, baby.
Yeah.
But let me also volunteer. That could be right. Like, so I see people present things as, oh, it's a mathematical certainty and whatever. And I think things like the Big Short does this where people know, right, and guys like Michael Burry or whatever know that an outcome can happen. It is so hard to convey how brutal the uncertainty of markets is and how self-eroding that uncertainty is, because you'd never know. You never, ever know. And also, it did a pretty good job in that movie and in the book of expressing that when you're halfway through that process and you've begun to see very serious default rates in the master trust data in the books of subprime stuff, but none of the prices are reacting, then you've got to think, well, maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe
I'm wrong. There's something about this that doesn't make sense. So, and by the way, that could have been the case. You know, there could have been something about that setup that was missed by guys like Burry or you know, we were short, you know, American financials at that time. And we took those shorts off.
Oh, really?
We took those shorts off. So just before Bear Stearns, I'm going to say 4 months-ish before Bear Stearns, but we had shorted these things for at least 10 years before. I mean, we shorted Conseco Homes to zero in 2001 and 2 because this subprime stuff was obvious. It was just awful.
Yeah.
You know, the accounting was terrible. So it was all, in inverted commas, cash accounting. So you're a subprime provider. You put together a book of loans.
Yeah.
You securitize them, flick them out, and you count that as profit today.
Oh, okay.
That's what cash accounting meant.
Was that like a completely different example, but Slater and Gordon, where they were recognizing all their potential work as revenue?
That sounds a lot like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like it. I don't know the ins and outs of that, but it sounds exactly that.
Yeah.
And I use that term prevailing bias. That's a term straight out of Soros, right? So Soros's thing is, these machines don't work around equilibria. They are constantly in disequilibrium. And they're constantly, when I say machines, I mean markets, they're constantly being dominated by a prevailing bias. And once you understand what that prevailing bias is, you can either agree with it or disagree with it, right? And also understand that they're self-reimposing, they're they're self-perpetuating. That's his idea of reflexivity. And so, you know, and some of your younger listeners might just know Soros from like right-wing memes or whatever. Yeah. This guy was an absolute all-time great.
Yeah.
A genius, you know, 30% for 30 years, largely of his own money.
Mm.
And he laid his thought processes out for everybody to see in a whole number of books. And unbelievably brilliant at this. By the way, bad at maths.
Right.
Did like philosophy and I forget his other major at university, but was obsessed with the understanding the world. And he had access to tools that most people don't, because his large exposures that generated huge amounts of money was to borrow in one currency and buy another currency and use the borrowings to then buy financial assets underneath that.
Okay.
So he was making money in multiple different ways. So if he borrowed in Deutschmark and bought in dollars, right, he was short Deutschmark, long dollars before he bought a stock.
Mm.
And then he'd have a stock book underneath that as well. And then he'd buy index commodity futures around that as well. So, and he was doing that all basically in his head.
Yeah. Sounds like he was okay at maths.
he was really good at mathematical concepts.
Yeah.
So anyway, so where are we now? That prevailing bias has been explained. What do I think is actually happening in the economy? We're careening into recession.
Okay.
Just plowing into recession. just galloping into it. And that's bad for stocks. So,
well, yeah, it's bad for everything. Yeah. Galloping into recession.
Yeah. Now, Australia, I don't know anything about Australia. Like, you guys don't know heaps more about Australia. I spend my time in a little bubble that looks everywhere else. I don't have much time to look at Australia. I don't know. So I'm largely talking about the States, which is like the financing cycle that matters. So what do I see there? I see a deeply inverted yield curve, so twos, tens, and the Fed has published at least two research papers in the last 5 years that say, no, there's no explanatory value, no predictive value in the yield curve, especially not twos, tens, to which I say, I disagree.
Okay.
Not, you know, it's a family show.
We can bleep you out.
exactly. So what is a bank? A bank is a big thing that borrows short and lends long and has a government right to do that. So, and by definition, they borrow at zero duration, which is a deposit. So your deposit is a loan to the bank.
Yep.
And you can take it out any time. Yep. So it's a one, it's like a zero, you know, time horizon borrowing through to about 3 years. That's a wholesale funding market that banks operate in. So now what happens if the two-year treasury note is at, we're at 320 and the 10-year is at 270 and everything's priced off the back of those two things, banks automatically will say, well, hang on a minute, I'm not going to lend these guys, I'm not going to lend to, you know, Julian, Bryce and Alec because I'm borrowing at some rate that's set off, you know, 320 and these guys are, you know, their reference rates out there are set off 270, I'm going to tighten. Mm. What do we see observing? Huge tightening, massive tightening. So go and Google senior loan officer survey, Fred, and look at what that looks like. So the only times you've ever had both small business and medium and large business tightenings of this magnitude, recession, and the only times you've ever had a net 20% tight, which is where we got to Friday week ago, right? It's a recession. The only times you've ever had the forward indicators in, you know, so the three branches of the Fed Reserve take survey data from businesses. So the Texas, the Philly, and the New York Fed. The only time their future new orders have gone to zero simultaneously was 2008. That just happened last 2 weeks ago. And people say, but unemployment is really low and job ads are really high and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, just go and look at the shape of the unemployment curve and overlay that on recessions. It's always at the lows as you're going into recession. It's not the level, it's the rate of change that matters and the direction of travel that matters. So absent everything else on the monetary and fiscal side, this looks like an economy that is plowing into recession. And it's not a crisis. No one comes and helps in a recession. That's the whole point. So go and look at what the Fed is saying in their minutes. The greater risk would be not to restore price stability. Mm. We have a role in moderating demand.
Yeah.
They're direct quotes from the Fed minutes.
Yeah.
What does that mean? It means we're not coming to help everybody. We want to choke you out until your legs stop wiggling. Then we take the pressure off.
Yeah.
Because they have a dual mandate. One's unemployment or full employment, and one is price stability. That becomes a sole mandate in the presence of very low unemployment, obviously. And they've got the sitting president of the United States holding hour-long press conferences devoted just to inflation. And Jay Powell has the prior two Fed chairs openly criticizing the current sitting Fed chair's handling of inflation, totally unprecedented. So from a personal perspective, I think he's probably thinking, oh, you want me to control inflation, do you? Watch me dance.
Right?
You're going to and I've got four more years to do it.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the setup on the, you know, sort of lead indicators of the real economy side. And I just ask people to think about why the real economy didn't do anything for more than a decade in the post-GFC world in the presence of low interest rates. We had the longest but the dullest, the lowest average growth expansion of the post-war period with zero interest rates. So why are we so excited about interest rates going down a bit now? There's something else in the system. And that something else is bleedingly obvious. It's 10% per year GDP injected straight into people's bank accounts. That's what just happened. So if you look at corporate profitability, and people can just Google US corporate profits, unadjusted Fred, and go and look at that on the Federal Reserve's, you know, thing, the St. Louis Fed's data thing, and look at the shape of the curve. Amazing. Amazing. So US dollars billion pre-tax unadjusted earned by corporates went up 40% in 18 months.
Yeah, well.
Not from a recessionary low. I don't mean from the low of like the COVID 1 month low. I mean from a full employment, 2.5% inflation economy in 2019 at the end of the longest post-war expansion. But let me make it more concrete. The 2018-2019 is a reasonable economy in the States. The earnings of Google, Microsoft, Apple, and Meta, Meta, what a name, that they all basically double from 2019 to mid-2021. That's pretty unusual. So that's all happening all at once. What else is happening? Retail sales go up 20% in 18 months. The dollars in people's bank accounts, just the dollars in bank accounts go from 13 trillion to 18 trillion in 18 months. New business formation goes from a run rate of 3 million through cycle. It does, you know, look at the GFC. In 06, new business formation in the States was, you know, call it about 2.5 by the depths, million businesses per year. In the depths of the GFC in 2009-10, it went to like 2.3 million. So an amplitude of 0.2. That went up by 2 million in the same 18 months. So all these things will happen together all in the same 18 months. And so now people are anchored onto the most radical economic experiment in human history, and thinking that the earnings power of businesses in the last 2 years is reflective of their underlying earnings power. And I just ask people to think about how things look versus a full employment economy of 2019. Do they look cheap or expensive? And we're going to find out. We're going to find out. So because what's happening now is the largest fiscal contraction almost in history. So we're going from an 8 to 9% of GDP budget deficit at the margin. So change year on year, not the level, but the change year on year, 2020 versus 19, to an 8% contraction, 2022 versus 2021. So think of it as like a peak to peak, about 9 to -8. We've never done that before, apart from one time. So that one time was in the late 1940s. I don't know if you guys are history buffs. There's a big series of things that happened in the 40s, namely a big world war. We financed that, the US financed that with deficits. So they went from a 15% deficit to a 15% contraction of that deficit from about 46 to about 48. Then what happened? 48, 49 saw CPI go negative 3% monthly change year on year, which is the deepest deflation since the Great Depression, and corporate profits fell just in dollars billion by over 20%, nearly 25%, from 48 through 49, 50. So that's pretty sobering. And so when I see people doing the prevailing bias thing of, oh, cool, let's buy some stocks because interest rates are falling, I think that prevailing bias is wildly wrong and missing what is an enormous contraction in the underlying economy that's driving the earnings of the businesses they're buying. And the corporates are all telling you, not all, because I think there's some pretty nasty guidance out there that will prove pretty ordinary.
Okay.
But look at the fast cycle businesses versus the slow cycle businesses. This is the worst conditions in Meta's history, according to Zuckerberg. It's the first quarter on quarter decline in revenue ever in the firm's history. But Microsoft is telling you, oh, hey, we lowered guidance and missed it. We lowered 90 days ago, well, you know, a bit over 3 months ago now, and we missed that guidance on both revenue and profit. But our business will stay at its current level or re-accelerate from here on. What's going on? So Meta bad, Microsoft good. I mean, the easy answer is Microsoft's great business and it's contracted revenues and it's different. Maybe. But I'd posit a different thing. Meta is all small business.
Yeah, and it's fast.
So if a small business's revenue goes down and profitability is being squeezed, which is happening right now, go and look at the NFIB small business survey. You can see that. That's happening right now. They go, oh, sorry, Meta, I'm not going to pay for any advertising next week. Right? It's just bang. What happens if people contract for Azure or Office 365 or blah, blah, blah? That's a really slow budgeting cycle. So Chevron does their budget in wherever, November last year. Everything's bloody rosy. It's all good. They will sit down and do their budget for next year in like October, November. So they're not saying to Microsoft, oh, look, hey, we better talk about this. They're not saying anything. They're just, yeah, that's it. That's the contracted revenue for the year and that's the services we use and blah, blah, blah. And so I think Microsoft is seeing this enormous level of activity, maybe moderating it, well, obviously moderating at the margin because they missed revenue, you know, two quarters in a row. But they're just thinking, oh, no, whatever, that's just a blip. And my contention is that's just a fast cycle versus a slower cycle, and that slower cycle will catch up.
Well, Julian, let's take a look at where Platinum are seeing opportunities now. Before we do, though, we're just going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So, Julian, towards the start of the episode, you mentioned Platinum are looking for the overlooked, and you said that there seem to be more now than perhaps there were in the not-too-distant past. So, where are you seeing these opportunities? What is the overlooked?
So cyclicality, Bryce. So things that are responsive to fast nominal global growth. Right? So GDP growth, not growth as a sort of factor. So I'd ask people to think about BHP and Rio. So I'm old enough to remember when BHP and Rio were sort of rah-rah growth stocks at about the same share prices as now, 15 years ago, with a 1.5% dividend yield. That's now, I don't know, 6 or 7, grossed up about 10 for your franking credits. So that's a colossal derating of these businesses, right? Just in terms of the multiple of the thing they give me today, what people will pay for them. Now, we don't own either of those stocks. That's just an example. But that those things globally look really interesting over 5 to 10 years. One of the reasons we had very low inflation at the end of the last decade was because we were eating the seed corn. We were living off prior investment. So massive booms in investment in metals and mining, massive boom in investment in energy, in particularly shale, colossal boom prior to that in shipbuilding, and colossal boom prior to that in chip making. Then we get to the end of the last decade and everyone thinks, oh, well, inflation's really low. Well, yeah, that's because we spent like $5 trillion in shale and, you know, capex to mining capex to GDP in Australia went to 8 in the mining boom. And then it fell because we live in a cyclical economy. Right, so now those cycles have to be caught up because the COVID stimulus wave and the behavioural thing of physical stuff I can buy on Amazon, basically, versus services which I can't go and consume because I can't go outside, right? That then hit an underinvested field of possibility. And so that's what happened. So now we have to make up all that capex across energy and metals and mining and manufacturing and all sorts of things. So that is really interesting. However, in the near term, we are much, much more focused on capital preservation.
So on that point, you know, people who have listened to this interview are probably getting quite nervous right now. A few people might have pulled out their brokerage app and looking at some of the growth stocks in there and worrying. But at Platinum, you know, you have a mandate to be invested. You know, people, institutions and stuff give you money to invest. You can't sit at 100% cash. So I guess how is Platinum positioning the portfolio in that short term, galloping into a recession? What's going to happen next window?
So we raise cash in times where we're nervous, but we also short markets and stocks, and we can't sit in those. So if people go and look at a point in time, you know, at the end of last month, I think we weren't all that short, but over the sort of journey from about March through to now, we've almost never been shorter and had more cash our existence.
Okay.
And we've been around for 28 years.
Yeah.
So we are saying to anyone who'll listen across our suite of funds, for God's sake, preserve your capital.
Mm.
That's the stage of the cycle we're at.
Yeah.
Right? That's what we think. And it's
too late. Mine's already gone.
Well, get some more and then preserve it. So fully acknowledging that could be wrong. You know, the Fed could pivot, hey, it's not advice, you do you. That's what the world looks like to us. And in particular, what we think happens now is the truly great companies now come off. So what's happened is the reaper comes for the weak first, right? So you're more speculative, you're obviously loss-making,
Robin Hoods, your Pelotons.
Totally.
Like we saw it in the back end of last year.
Totally, but they peaked in January 01, if I'm getting my history right, as did biotech, which is classic. And we said this publicly like over a year ago, this is what happens in early bear markets. The froth gets cleaned up first and people rotate back to the great champions because they can't lose, right? Yeah, they bloody can. Mm. Just go and look at what happens to Microsoft through cycles. Go and look at it from, you know, sort of late 90s through mid 2000s. Go and look at it from 07 through to 2010. Smoked.
Yeah.
Smoked.
And that did start to play out. Like Apple was down, 20% at one stage, but it's come back on a bit.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Now, think about a pretty expensive consumer discretionary purchase over a couple of years of recession.
Mm.
I don't think that looks good at all.
Yeah.
Mm.
But I could be wrong.
I mean, Apple might even argue they're not consumer discretionary anymore, that they're a staple in everyone's lives.
they're right, but you do economize on staples.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that's what the world looks like to us.
Yeah, okay. And then in terms of your short book, is it a lot of those highly speculative, unprofitable tech names?
It has been.
Yeah.
It has been. And now more and more it's gravitating back to the champions.
Yeah. Okay.
To the champions. I have to be a bit careful about disclosure around shorts because it's like not – because they move quickly. So and it can be very misleading to say we're short this and then tomorrow we're not. But, yeah, that in by and large has been – so unprofitable tech – is a basket that Goldman Sachs put together. That's a great example of the kind of stuff we have been short.
Mm.
And now increasingly we're looking to short absolute champions.
Yeah,
things like, for example, not necessarily today, but maybe your Apples, your Microsofts, your CBAs.
Okay.
Your absolute bulletproof
CBA
businesses.
Would be stoked that they're just been bucketed with Apple and Microsoft.
Well, it's got that kind of vibe, right?
Yeah,
it's the best bank in a pretty good market and it's going to be fine and it's been a widowmaker trade forever and it'll never go down and it's never going to, we'll see.
So, Julian, for a retail investor who's sitting at home that doesn't have the luxury of being able to short as easily as some of the big institutions to preserve some of their capital and sitting there with a philosophy as well of not selling your positions in a market crash, because we all know it's probably one of the worst times to sell.
We're not in a market crash yet.
Okay, well, leading up to a market crash.
Yeah.
My portfolio tells me we're in a market crash.
Certainly hasn't been a market boom.
What are some practical ways that we should think about preserving capital if we don't have those sort of techniques or tools available to us?
Your two great asset allocations at a time like this are cash and patience. Cash and patience. And everyone will say, oh, cash doesn't earn a return, blah, blah, blah. It's like, okay, but think about a world that just got mega returns and then average that forward over time, you're preserving those returns by holding some cash, right? And cash is an option. It's an option to go and do anything with it.
Yeah.
You know? So that's really, really important. I think that's amplified in a place like Australia that has massive levels of household debt, where people are basically leveraged long what is kind of a risk asset in their house, and then they want to go and own a whole lot of other risk assets in the form of equities. So they're running a little household hedge fund and they're massively leveraged long. And they want to think about, okay, well, what happens in a relatively serious, not, and again, it's not going to be like the GFC. It's not a crisis, like I said before. So it's not like, oh, I'm going to vomit and, you know, the banks are all going broke and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
People, if people can remember, remember. If people can't, ask someone, what was the early 90s like? What was the early 80s like?
Yeah.
And it's just dreary. You
yeah.
Know?
Wow.
Yeah.
It's not like a systemic crisis no. where the economy is going to collapse. It's just slower growth or yeah. less growth, no yeah. growth. Yeah.
Or less or negative growth
yeah.
with central banks wanting to. And by the way, all that stuff before about central banks and inflation wasn't normative. I don't think they should tighten here because what did I just say? Cash and patience. Well, they can print the cash and they got a lot. They should have more patience.
Yeah.
So why am I saying that? Well, the boom in stimulus stuff happened in 2020 and it wasn't really observable as a proven, you know, hey, we're getting too hot here until almost 2 years later. And so now that's all reversing and central banks want to tighten into it.
Mm.
Maybe that's a good idea. I doubt it.
Mm.
So no one's coming to help from CPI in this country of, what is it, 6 and CPI in the States of 8.5 and CPI in England of 9.1, 9.2, CPI in Europe of 9. CPI in China beginning to accelerate towards 3, Japan beginning to accelerate, you know, towards 1 or 2. These are average rates of inflation not seen for decades and decades. And so, yeah, they're going to tighten into that. They probably shouldn't. They probably should wait, but that's what's going to happen.
I mean, there are so many ways we can go from here. We haven't spoken about China, and I know Platinum and you've got views on China. We haven't spoken about active management VETF.
Let me give you a quick summary of China.
No.
It's boring.
It's boring. It's boring.
Boring is good. Boring's fine. It's boring.
Nice.
We'll come back to another time.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're going to have to get you back on to talk about these things because there's so much more to unpack. But we have run out of time and we do like to finish with the same final three questions. So we'll get into them. But before we do, if people can't wait until you come back and join us again and they want to hear more from you, follow you online, anywhere in particular they should go.
I'm on LinkedIn. And that's it for me for social media.
Nice.
Start doing
good way
else.
To be.
You're not seeing Bryce's clickbait on Instagram then.
Yeah, exactly.
You're missing out.
Yeah, I'm preserving my sanity. Not vis-a-vis you, Bryce. I mean, vis-a-vis the medium. Else. I'm on LinkedIn and that's just a purely, I don't know about professional, but that's just work stuff, right? Mm. I don't really like social media. I don't want to expose myself to it. You know, go and look at our website, platinum.com.au, and there's a bit on there called The Journal, and that's got a whole bunch of our thoughts about the world constantly.
Great. And keep subscribed to Equity Mates because we'll get Julian back on in the future.
Please do.
But we'll get to our final three questions. We'll make them rapid fire.
Yep.
The first one, do you have any books that you consider must read?
Yeah, The Alchemy of Finance by George Soros, The Misbehavior of Markets by Benoit Mandelbrot, and One Up on Wall Street or Betting the Street by Peter Lynch.
Yeah.
Nice.
Nice. Second question, forget valuation, forget the idea of investing in them today, just purely on who the company is, what it does, and who it's run by. What's the best company you've ever come across?
Wrigley's Chewing Gum.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a phenomenal business. Phenomenal business. Got taken out by Buffett and Mars in, I'm going to say, 2009. Just an incredible business. So it didn't have any barriers. So ethnically, culturally, whatever. No one really cares about chewing apart from Singapore. So it could open all these new markets. Let me give you an example of how it opened markets.
Yeah.
When the Berlin Wall fell in 89 and Russia sort of began to really open from 91 on, they were one of the first American businesses in, and they kept on finding that their delivery trucks would get knocked off for the cash. So they formed armed convoys.
No way.
And delivered the chewing gum in these convoys and took cash on delivery and then repatriated that. Like that kind of business.
Wow.
With unbelievable return profile, you know, sort of 20% return on capital profile over 100 odd years or a bit short of that. A truly brilliant business. Never had a dollar of debt. In the war, for example, it began to run into shortages and it just said, sorry, we're not going to sell to anyone in the public. We're going to send all our chewing gum to the troops.
Yeah,
you know, just stuff like that. Just a brilliant understanding of their own business and the societies they operate in and an incredible return profile that just, you know, the margins on a stick of gum is really very high, but then they're constantly innovating around that as well. You know, the stuff, the airwaves or the stuff that cleans your teeth or the packaging formats change, but the underlying single thing never changes in price. So you can buy the one at the same price, which is really low, or you go to the, you know, the big tubs of it and that's a much higher price point per stick of gum. Mm. Just incredible business.
Yeah, nice. Great. Love that answer. And then, Julian, final question. If you think back to your early days as an investor, starting off on the right foot, investing in Macquarie at $18, what advice would you give your younger self?
Be more patient. Yeah, be more patient. That would be my advice.
Nice. Love that.
Great way to close, given where the market's at the moment. Time of recording, the NASDAQ ripped into a bull market overnight. Good to have a sobering and more realistic view of where the world might be at, but do your own research. Check out the resources on the Platinum page as well. It's certainly an interesting time and you've left us a lot to ponder, Julian. So thank you very much for sharing your time with us and the Equity Mates community. It's a pleasure.
My great pleasure. Thanks. And thanks for what you're doing as well. It's great. It's really good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Equity Mates. We love hearing from you. So drop us a line at contact@equitymates.com or even better, go to your podcast player and leave a 5-star review. Also, a reminder that the Equity Mates content train doesn't stop when you've run out of episodes to binge. We've got a brand new website, a Facebook discussion group. We're on Instagram, YouTube, and slowly making our way as an influencer on TikTok. Well, that's Ren. So come and say hello and join the community. We'd love to welcome you. Until next time.
Equity Mates Investing Podcast is a product of Equity Mates Media. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. Equity Mates gives listeners access to information and educational content provided by a range of financial service professionals. It is not intended as a substitute for professional finance, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Equity Mates Investing Podcast are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Equity Mates Media does not operate under an Australian Financial Services License and relies on the exemption available under the Corporations Act 2001 in respect of any information or advice given. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement and, if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. Do not take financial advice from a podcast or video. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the Equity Mates website, where you can find ASIC resources and find a registered financial professional near you. In the spirit of reconciliation, Equity Mates Media and the hosts of Equity Mates Investing Podcast acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.